This is the Meridian Podcast.
I'm Amelia Hardy.
I'm Michael Gorhan.
And welcome to the new series of the Meridian Podcast.
On today's episode, we're joined by a journalistic icon, a woman who's reported from the front lines of some of the most devastating and defining conflicts of our times. CNN's chief international correspondent, Clarissa Ward.
In over a decade as an international correspondent, Clarissa has reported from some of the most dangerous conflict zones on the planet, including Syria during the Syrian uprising, Afghanistan during the US withdrawal, and now Ukraine. On today's episode, we're delighted to be speaking with Clarissa about her astonishing career as an international correspondent, what it's taught her, and what tips she has for the young journalists of today.
So sit back, relax, and welcome to this episode of the Meridian Podcast.
Right. So we are really excited to be joined today by CNN's chief international correspondent, Clarissa Ward. Clarissa, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So you've reported from numerous conflict zones across your career, including Iraq, Afghanistan, and most recently Ukraine. And somehow amongst all of that, you've managed to find time to write a book, which is entitled On All Fronts, The Education of a Journalist, which will be linked in the description of the podcast. We definitely recommend everybody grabs a copy of, because it is absolutely fantastic.
Thank you.
You write in the book that kind of being a journalist wasn't necessarily always on your radar, and that something happened in 2001 that kind of seemed to bring you, that you described as a calling to journalism. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about that.
So I guess most of your listeners are probably too young to remember 9/11. But I'm sure they're at least familiar with what happened. And I was a student at Yale University in the US. I was studying comparative literature. I thought that I wanted to be an actress because I was really into storytelling and travel and adventure and film and theater. And then 3 days into my final year, my senior year of college, 9/11 happened. And it's really difficult, I think, to convey like just how shocking it was to watch these two buildings, the Twin Towers that I had grown up going to as a little girl, and you'd go up to the top floor and look down, and they were really a symbol of America. And watching them crumble to the ground, and the sort of shock and the destruction and the devastation. And I just felt this strong sense of, first of all, I think shame that I hadn't really understood like what was going on in the world and how America was viewed by some people in the world and why it was viewed that way. And that I just wasn't more engaged with the news in general. I followed the news, but I wasn't like deeply into it. So I had this conviction, which sort of came out of nowhere in that moment, that this whole sort of tragic, hideous act of terror was really kind of born out of a complete breakdown of communication, of ordinary humans communicating. And I had this sense that I wanted to try to act as a translator between worlds to help, you know, ensuring that things like this didn't happen again. And so obviously I was like 22 and or even 21, and I was full of hubris and idealism, and I didn't really understand exactly what that meant. But I knew that I wanted to be a journalist, and I knew that I wanted to go to the tip of the spear, wherever that was. And yeah, try to like improve our understanding of the world and try to improve the world's understanding of us.
Mm. You call it sort of the tip of the spear, Did you always know then at the same time that you wanted to be a journalist that you wanted to specifically be a conflict reporter?
I think I understood that implicitly. And I don't really know why, because I wasn't one of these kids who was like really into like climbing mountains and like hang gliding and or any kind of an adrenaline junkie or any kind of like extreme camping and adventure, like none of that stuff. But to me, what was interesting always was this idea of like getting to places that everybody says you can't get to, and talking to people that everybody says will never talk to you, and sort of trying to reach the unreachable. I think that was really my primary preoccupation, rather than being like on the front lines, because it's not that that was so appealing to me. It was about getting to those hard to reach places.
And I mean, you immediately did sort of go to hard to reach places. Sort of after leaving university, your first job was at Fox on the overnight desk. And then obviously you were at the age of 25, I think you were posted in Baghdad again with Fox. What were those sort of early experiences of journalism like? And what did you learn from them?
Well, first I would just say, it felt like a really long time between having this epiphany on 9/11 that I wanted to do this kind of journalism, and then actually getting to Baghdad 2.5 years later. Or actually it was really 3 years later, or almost 3 years later. So I had to do a lot of hard graft, like most people do when they leave uni. I had to work overnight shifts and work on the desk and all this stuff that wasn't really what I dreamed of doing. But which is kind of inevitable and actually helps build character and give you a different, deeper understanding of like news gathering more broadly. I think the first time I got to Baghdad, I was 25, as you said, completely just in thrall of how exciting this was and how fascinating this was. And I was like learning so much, like every fiber of my being was taking in new stimulus, new information. I had so many questions and everything was kind of fascinating and bizarre and new and thrilling and exciting. And you felt like, you know, you were in a movie or something. And the lesson you learn, and in my case, it was pretty quickly, it was on my second trip when there was a triple suicide car bombing attack on the hotel that I was living in. The lesson you learn quite quickly, and hopefully in not as dramatic fashion as I learned it, but is that like, there's nothing glamorous about war. There's nothing, you know, we have a tendency to fetishize war as a society, and in books and in movies, we make it look like impossibly glamorous. And actually, like, war is just abject horror and hell and misery. And that's what war is. And I think the first time I went to Baghdad, I didn't really understand that or feel that. I was too wrapped up in how exciting it was. And it was only later that I really understood that in a sort of powerful way. And I'm glad that I learned it soon, because it's a really important reminder, especially when you keep your focus on the fact that, like, it's not really about you and your experiences in war zones, right? It's about the people whose stories you're telling. And they're definitely not thinking it's all really glamorous and exciting, right? They're probably at the lowest moments in their lives. And so it's good to be attuned to that and in touch with that, and not getting carried away with your own kind of like, wow, my life is so much cooler than my friends from uni who are like working in a bank.
Yeah, absolutely. Was so you spoke about the triple suicide bombing. Was that really the moment that kind of it kicked in for you, that kind of how real it was? And what were you thinking as that was kind of unfolding?
I think that was the first moment that I'd ever experienced any like real real threat to my life. And it really was a real threat. Like we definitely could have died. You know, there were three suicide bombers, and the final one was in this huge cement truck loaded with explosives. And his truck got stuck on some razor wire about 100 meters from the hotel. And that's what saved us, because he couldn't get past this razor wire. And then he knew that someone was going to shoot him, so he just blew himself up about 100 meters away, caused an obscene amount of damage. And like the ceilings were coming in, and like doors popped off their hinges, and every glass window was completely smashed, and people were like cut and bruised and bloody. But if he had gotten through that razor wire and had got to like near the entrance of the hotel, we probably all would be dead. So in that moment, all that I could think, honestly, the main thing that kept going through my head was like, why am I here? like I could actually die. Like, this is actually real. It's not a game. It's not a, you know, a holiday. It's not just some weird experience. Like, it's real. And that just was very sobering and very important. Now, the problem is that, not the problem, but the reality rather is that, like, once you survive it, a different feeling kicks in, which is like, I survived, I didn't die. I'm here to tell the story, how exhilarating, how extraordinary. And so, you know, it's easy to become addicted to that feeling of just being so alive. But the important thing is not to forget that feeling of like very real fear. You don't want to let it like dictate everything you do or overshadow everything you do, but it is really important to remember, like, it's not, none of it is a game. It's deadly serious. And anytime you're tempted to just sort of run off and do something that's maybe a little bit dangerous, like, no, sit down, hash it out, and come up with a plan that's safe, because like, this is real.
Real life, very, very scary by the sounds of it. Maybe some good advice for anybody thinking of going into war correspondence.
You
talked about sort of the excitement and the adrenaline, and a particularly interesting sort of part of your book was when you talked about that feeling like you just did that, of addiction, that you became sort of like addicted to the feeling of being alive. But another sort of feeling that you speak about a lot in your book is fear. And I've, of course, you've reported from Syria and Afghanistan, and I mean, particularly Syria is an incredibly and was an incredibly dangerous place to report from. Your fellow war correspondent, Marie Colvin, was killed in Syria. And then you gave an address to the United Nations about Aleppo, where you sort of described it as hell on earth, which is a really sobering speech that you gave. So I was just wondering, because many people might sort of question whether and the intensity that you actually feel fear, but of course you do, but how do you deal with that in the field?
So I think, you know, the problem with fear, like, first of all, there, I'm sure there are some people who don't feel fear, but I would say that they're dangerous. Fear is important. It has a really, really important evolutionary aspect too, right? Like, fear like helps us stay alive as human beings, because it tells us when situations are dangerous and we should leave. So fear is there for a good reason, and you shouldn't try to like get rid of it. But what you have to learn to do is control it. So fear is closely linked to panic. Panic can get you into a lot of trouble in war zones and can create very dangerous situations. So I typically, early on in my career, like, I would say that like fear really was the driving force. So I would feel fear and I'd be like, I'm just going to hide here. And even if hiding at that moment was the stupidest thing you could possibly do. And I relied on people who were more experienced than I was to guide me in terms of like, no, you can't, you've got to run in this situation, or you've got to take cover in this situation, or you got to do this or that. And then as you get more experience, you learn to basically acknowledge the fear, and it can be sitting in the passenger seat. It just can't be in the driver's seat. And so in the driver's seat, there has to be like a cool, rational, calm voice that is methodically going through, this is what just happened. This is what that means. This is our actions on for this type of a situation. This is what we need to do next. This is how we have to get out of here. So we were in Ukraine, I think in April, we're in an apartment building with some paramedics, and like, you know, a volley of rockets just came into the entrance next door. So just like, you know, whatever it was, 15 meters away, you know, we're taking cover, we're under a stairwell. And of course you want to just like run in that situation, but you can't, because there could be more rockets coming. And so you've just got to sit and wait until you feel confident that there isn't another volley coming right away. And so, you know what I mean? Like, it's, you have to learn to work with your team and think things out, not from a place of fear, but from a place of like logical, rational thinking. And that's much easier said than done when you're really in the thick of it. but over time you get better at it.
Yeah,
it must be a real sort of element of trust then between you and sort of your producer and cameraman working on the ground. Is that something kind of that you
1,000%. So, I mean, one of the main reasons I was drawn to television over print was because I really like the team element of it and having that collaboration and that camaraderie. And there's no question that I work with the same team almost all the time. Mm-hmm. I really trust them with my life and vice versa. And that's huge. That makes a huge difference when you're going into a dangerous place, knowing that you're with people where, like, first of all, you know how they're going to react. You know what they're going to do in certain situations, and you know that they've got your back. Mm-hmm. Like, that's massive. It's much more frightening to go into a dangerous situation with someone you haven't worked with before. Like, you don't really know their style. You don't know if they're going to, like, start flapping or if they're going to, you know, just work in a way that you're not used to. Mm-hmm. So yeah, your team is everything. Your team is everything in this industry.
Yeah, I can imagine. Just really, really need to trust each other, especially in situations like you had in Ukraine there. I remember watching that and it was very much a heart in the mouth kind of scenario. I wanted to ask you a bit about, you know, being a woman in the industry. Mm-hmm. Because it seems to me from kind of your descriptions of your work in the book that there's kind of two sides to it. So on the one hand, you've got this kind of incredible access to parts of society that your male colleagues don't. Mm. So there was the one story you're writing about when you were in Syria and kind of you were able to go in and like sit with the women and kind of obviously you describe them as like a fountain of knowledge. But then on the other hand, you've got kind of this added risk that sexism brings. Mm. So there's the, obviously you were told by the Taliban to kind of cover your face, stand to the side. And then there was, I think both of us were curious about the run-in with Saif Gaddafi in the back of a car in Moscow. Yeah. So what's it like kind of balancing that?
So, I mean, for the most part, I feel like it's an advantage being a woman. But I'm also one of those women who feel like I'm really glad I was born a woman in the sense of like, you know, some people are like, oh, it's so crap or, you know, whatever. I'm like, no, I'm into this.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And I'm into like the advantages that I think it gives me in my profession. And I often joke that there's like, sometimes it's a great thing to be underestimated. And that's, you know, the kind of sexism that you're talking about. You experience it a lot, especially in societies that may be a bit more conservative where like women don't have certainly similar roles to what I do. But they don't necessarily view you as a threat. Like my Western male colleagues might be seen as a threat. I'm seen as more of a curiosity and like someone with a really indulgent, patient husband and sort of a weirdo as opposed to a danger. And that enables me to kind of to get around more, to talk to people more, to sit with the women, as you mentioned, which is huge. That's like 50% of the population that my male colleagues don't get to engage with in certain societies. So I think that that is pretty massive, to be honest. I've been able to like sit in the back of a car and drive through a checkpoint and just pretend to be asleep. And they see like a woman sleeping in the back of the car. They're just not as suspicious, let's say. Obviously I can cover my hair, which makes it less obvious depending on where I am that I'm a Westerner. So I, for a number of reasons, I have felt like it's an advantage. There is obviously like always the threat, although it exists for my male colleagues too, but in a different way, but there is a threat of like sexual assault. I know journalists, female journalists who have been assaulted before, and you're definitely conscious of that. And obviously it's kind of a horrifying thought. I've been lucky so far. And you're going to be up against sexism in all sorts of, not just in war zones, by the way, you know, back in London or in New York. And that's, again, it's not ideal. It's come a long way. But at, you know, my motto has always been like, this isn't really about me. You know what I mean? So like, yeah, is this annoying? You know, or yeah, is the Saif Gaddafi thing like unpleasant? Yeah, it is. But my thing has been like, you know, like pull up your bootstraps and get on with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because ultimately this isn't all about me. This is about the people whose stories I'm telling, who are subjected to far worse on all fronts than I ever am. So,
yeah.
And I kind of think like, you know, not to sound sort of, I think we can be a little bit precious sometimes about a lot of this stuff, which is not to like say it's okay or to endorse it, but just to be like, you know, I don't know, especially if you want to do this job. This job is tough in many ways. So like if you're a little bit delicate on that or easily offended, like it's probably not the job for you, honestly. Yeah. So that's kind of how I take it. It's like sometimes it happens, it's annoying, and I just turn the page on it, move on.
Brush it off. Yeah. That seems like a good approach.
But I mean, obviously I say that with the caveat of like, I haven't had like a horrifying run-in.
Yeah.
And I know women who have, so I don't want to dismiss that.
That's from the situation that you've been in.
And it's a threat and you have to, you know, try and do whatever you can to mitigate it. Although it is pretty random.
On the topic of gender, I think Afghanistan is probably now a good place to move to. Obviously, the Taliban have sort of swept through the country last year, and we were all stunned to watch you on CNN. As that was happening in live time, you were speaking with the Taliban. Can you just describe what that was like, watching that unfold and speaking with the very people that were sort of overthrowing after the withdrawal?
I mean, it was definitely surreal. I had been on the ground already for 2 weeks and was just doing the story of like all the gains that the Taliban was making, but no one expected them to sweep through Kabul in a matter of hours with like hardly a shot fired. That was not on the cards, or we didn't think it was. So it was pretty shocking when it happened as quickly as it did. I had one distinct advantage, I think, over some of my colleagues, which was that I had just spent a couple of days with the Taliban in Ghazni province. So, and I was working with an Afghan-British filmmaker who had done a lot of projects with the Taliban and had good relations with them and knew them well. So unlike most people, I wasn't as frightened of the Taliban, which isn't to say that I didn't like underestimated the threat they posed, but it was more that I understood like that there was a way as Westerners to operate with them. And there were like clear rules, but if you were operating within the sort of schema of those rules, like you would probably be okay. So most of my colleagues went immediately to the airport, which ended up being the focus of the story anyway, to a certain extent. But we felt comfortable like being out on the streets. And as you say, like just asking and the Taliban were in such a good mood because they had just pulled off this like epic takeover and, you know, essentially humiliated the greatest superpower in the world. So they were feeling jubilant. And as a result, they were feeling, I think, pretty indulgent of journalists. It was a different mood outside the airport, where my producer very nearly got his skull cracked open by some Taliban fighters. So it wasn't that it was without risk. It was definitely like a very unstable time. But you just had to approach with caution, introduce yourself, make it clear that you had the right permissions, and hope for the best. And then the only other thing I would say is like, you know, my main memory of that period is less even about the jubilant Taliban, although of course, you know, that was very striking, but it was more about like the absolute shock and horror of ordinary Afghan people, particularly those living in Kabul, who within a matter of hours, their whole life was just turned upside down, and they were panicked and fearful and devastated. And just so much heartache and so much sadness. I think that, and so much desperation. And that's not something you forget easily.
Mm. No, I can't imagine it is. And, you know, it still feels surreal because, you know, personally, we'd been in Afghanistan longer than I'd been alive. Mm. So to kind of see the whole withdrawal happen and the Taliban come through so quickly was like, still even watching back on the reporting now, it feels incredibly surreal. And for the Taliban to then come in and claim that they've sort of changed, that they're not the Taliban of the 1990s, from your experience, has that been sort of the case, or is it still very much back to the way things were in Afghanistan?
So I think that, like, I don't think that the Taliban have fundamentally changed since the 1990s in terms of their ideology, but I think that the people of Afghanistan have.
Mm.
And I think that the fact that everybody is online and has smartphones and are on social media, like, that's a game changer. That has fundamentally shifted the way Afghans experience life and the way the world is connected to that experience. And so there are elements of the Taliban who understand that and who I think would like to see certain modifications made. So, for example, the issue of women's education, right? Currently, girls in Afghanistan can't go to school after like sixth grade. So when they're 12 years old, basically, once they hit puberty is the idea, they can no longer go to school. Now, privately, there are many Taliban leaders who would like to see that changed. But publicly, because there is resistance in some areas, the Taliban's supreme leader's attitude, I think, is that I can't risk the Taliban splintering as a group into different factions. Like, we need to remain unified. And so we have to wait until everyone's on board and we have consensus before we'll ever go ahead and kind of like make changes or implement new rules. Which is, on the one hand, like, you can understand the logic for it, but on the other hand, it's like, you know, it's like they're just not living in the real Afghanistan anymore. And I think as long as you see this kind of reluctance to shift their thinking and to adapt a more pragmatic and practical approach, the longer you're going to see the protracted misery of people in Afghanistan, because there's a real knock-on effect mm-hmm. in terms of aid, in terms of unfreezing the central bank's assets. And it's really kind of like slowing down any sort of relief that the Afghan people are entitled to, honestly. So I'm not confident that it's going to change, because at the end of the day, like, it, you know, they had some of the top Muslim scholars in the world went to Afghanistan to sit down with the Taliban and be like, hey, and these are not like Brits or Americans or Westerners, they're like Malaysians and Saudis, and, you know, and they're like, this girls' education thing, there's no Muslim country in the world where girls can't be educated. And they, so they really tried to appeal to them Islamically, like, look at this verse, look at this, you know, hadith. And it didn't have an effect, because ultimately, like, it's not really about Islam either, right? It's about like cultural, historical practices that have been baked in over many, many decades. And so that is much harder to reverse and to undo. And the Taliban have to be a little bit careful as well, because there are some hardcore hardliners within the Taliban. And if they lose the support of those guys, they can potentially pose a threat to them. So, which is not to say that like the Taliban is doing a good job or that we should feel sorry for the Taliban. We shouldn't. They made basic promises. They have not kept them. And they have a debt of responsibility to the women of that country, which they are failing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's interesting that you talk about the people of Afghanistan changing, because between sort of after the Taliban were removed from power, I think it was in 2001, that the literacy rate, for example, doubled among women. So women have tasted, that generation of women have tasted freedoms that their mothers haven't. Do you think, and did you experience on the ground that made it particularly difficult for that sort of generation of women in Afghanistan to deal with the Taliban takeover?
So I would say two things. The first thing, which is important to say, is like not everyone in Afghanistan changed over the last 20 years, and not everyone had access to the opportunities that came with the sort of US occupation, or not just US, US, UK. And for many people, it was a terrible thing. And if you go to parts of Helmand province, no one was crying when the Americans left. They were doing a jig, okay, and trying, now they're trying to rebuild their lives, because all they knew of the US presence in Afghanistan was like war and drone strikes and arbitrary detentions and fighting and ugliness. So, and girls who live in those areas have never been educated, and it's not a priority. It's not something they talk about. It's not something that's even part of their worldview. Those girls, and I've spent time with them, they don't leave the house. They live at home all the time. They might occasionally go out with a male escort, but that's it. So I want to be clear that, like, when, you know, the women of Afghanistan are not a monolith, right? It's not just like one model that exists. At the same time, there were so many women, and not just in Kabul, who did benefit hugely. And as you said, the proof is in the pudding when you look at like the literacy rate, for example. But also when you look at like maternal mortality, they were benefiting on like healthcare level, because before you had a real scarcity of, you know, doctors who could even treat women because of all this like intense gender segregation stuff. And for those women, I mean, I never forget interviewing one woman, spoke beautiful English, and she was absolutely hysterical. This is like 2 or 3 days after the Taliban took over. She had worked for a Western aid agency, and she had two daughters. And she was just like, "What do I tell my daughters? How do I explain to my daughters that everything I told them about having dreams and what do you want to do? And do you want to become a judge, or do you want to be an MP, or do you want to start your own company, or like, and you know, what university do you want to, you know, what do you want to study at university?" That all of that is no longer on the table for you. That is no longer an option for you. How do I explain that to them? And you know, that is like, I mean, that is heartbreaking. And as a mother, I mean, I can tell you, I can't even imagine having to have that conversation with my kids.
It just seems so incredibly heartbreaking, and so much of the work you've done is kind of telling that story of the everyday Afghan people. And I'm just wondering, just one more quick question on Afghanistan before we move on. Like, is that what Afghanistan's future looks like? So with everything going on at the moment, there's just been this suicide bombing, which was just utterly horrific. And girls, like you said, can't go to school above the sixth grade. Is this what the future looks like for women and girls for the foreseeable future?
I mean, unfortunately, it sort of appears that way. I would love to be able to tell you that I see positive movements or developments that encourage me for the future. The one thing I see that's positive is I see the incredible strength and resilience of Afghan girls and women, and they're not just docile victims, and they're not just taking this sitting down. When I was last in Afghanistan, they're like basically taking advantages of loopholes and continuing their studies and continuing their education, but they're doing them at learning centers instead of like official schools, which is kind of brilliant. And the Taliban is, you know, for the most part, leaving that alone. The problem becomes that they don't get an official diploma at the end of that. So, like, they continue their studies, but they don't get recognition of it at the end of that. So, I'm sort of amazed by the courage of Afghan women, and so impressed by like their tenacity and their ability to keep fighting. But I fear that they, you know, will continue to face a really long, uphill slog.
Yeah. You talked there about sort of an uphill slog, and another sort of scenario where that seems to be playing out is obviously Ukraine after Vladimir Putin invaded. Obviously, there's been so-called referendums now, and also conscription, so a lot of developments there. But I'm interested to know, when did you begin thinking that an invasion was possible? Did you feel that that was a likely possibility going into Ukraine?
No. So I lived in Russia in 2007 for 2 years. I've been going to Ukraine since the Maidan Revolution in 2014. I obviously, like most journalists, was there this year from early January because the US was saying every day that Russia was going to invade. And I could tell you that the vast majority of us who knew Russia well and had spent time there were united in completely rejecting this idea. We were like, there's no way Putin's going to invade. It doesn't make sense. He doesn't stand to benefit from it. It's way too outrageous and crazy. And it will ultimately cost him. The moment where I understood that it actually was going to happen was about 2 days before the invasion, where he gave a 57-minute speech in which he acknowledged the Donbass, these two breakaway regions of Luhansk and Donetsk, as being independent. And actually, the headline of the speech was not him saying these areas are independent, but him banging on for nearly an hour about how Ukraine basically doesn't have a right to exist and is kind of an extension of Russia. And that was the first moment where I was like, oh, wow, this is really going to happen. And I think it caught so many of us by it shocked a lot of us. And first of all, we realized, wow, okay, we weren't just part of like some media strategy for the Americans. Like, they were actually sincerely sharing intelligence in real time with the whole world with the hopes of stopping this thing. But it required a complete like reframing of like everything you thought you knew about Russia and everything you thought you knew about President Putin is not quite true. And everything that you thought was maybe a bit far-fetched and a bit extreme and a bit like, you know, was actually true. And the minute he did it as well, it's like all those things that seemed obvious, but over the, like, it's like, no, that was all, it was all there for you to see if you were looking in the right place. So I felt pretty humbled by it as someone who considers myself to like have a decent amount of knowledge about Russia. I was really shocked by the invasion.
Yeah.
Because hindsight is always a helpful thing though, yeah, in terms of that. With kind of your expertise on Russia and how much you know, and I imagine you're speaking to people inside the country as well. What are you thinking about whether Vladimir Putin can actually hold on to power? Because obviously to somebody in the West, you look at the protests and people might think, oh, well, there must be some sort of regime change on the marks. Obviously, you've got people fleeing in their thousands. But when it comes to Russia, that's not always the case. So what's the future looking like for him?
I think President Putin is definitely weaker than we've ever seen him before. And the reason he is in such a jam right now is less even because of the protests at home, although obviously that complicates his life, because for the last 6 months, the war in Ukraine was basically something that Russians only saw on their TV sets. It wasn't part of reality for them. Their lives hadn't actually changed that much despite the sanctions. So now it's like real for them. And so that definitely has contributed to kind of like instability and unhappiness and all of that. But the real jam he's in is because Russia can't really win this war as it stands. And he has kind of staked a claim that they must win this war. So unless he can win the war, he's sort of very vulnerable or arguably dead man walking. Which options does that leave him with then? He's got to find a way, if not to win it outright, to present some form of something that can look like or can be fashioned into a victory for people back home, which is all that really matters. So he is facing the fight of his life, honestly. I think that the way he has hoped to win the war is because, or is with this sort of like, let's just keep grinding. Let's have a war of attrition that's going to last years. And eventually the Ukrainians will be exhausted and the Europeans will be feeling too much economic pain and the Americans will be mired in their own domestic politics and Russia, which has a higher pain threshold than anyone, will be able to kind of just call it a day. But with the momentum that the Ukrainians now have on the battlefield with these counteroffensives and with the absolute shambles that the Russian military is in right now, that is not necessarily a reliable strategy. So that's part of why you're seeing him suddenly talk about nukes. And, you know, I'm not bluffing. And I think he's trying to like re-inject fear into the battle space because Russia's military has been sort of incompetent on the ground. He now wants to, you know, have people feel afraid of Russia again. So to what extent he's able to achieve that, I don't know. I do feel like this is an incredibly dangerous inflection point in this conflict, though, and that at some point there probably needs to be a conversation about what kind of an exit ramp he might have, because understandably, a lot of people are just saying, well, you know, that's it. He's done. He's toast. Like, let him fail. Let him fall. The thing you have to take into consideration if you're, you know, a Western leader or if you're a Ukrainian leader is like, who comes next? Who follows? And are they going to be better? And I use the word better in commas for like world, you know, the world stability. So it's a very complicated, very tense time. And I think that he is really fighting for his life. So don't underestimate him at the same time, you know, when someone's back against a wall and they are fighting for their life, like, they're probably not going down without quite a fight.
Very true.
No, absolutely. As a journalist, what is it like reporting on something as sort of era-defining as that? Because there are certain moments that sort of shift the trajectory of history, and this is definitely one of them. And, you know, the saying that sort of journalists write the first draft of history. Do you feel that pressure, and do you feel that this... Is it different when you're reporting on a moment that is, or at least feels, as era defining as this?
Yeah, I mean, I will say that I've covered a lot of hugely important stories, but I think you're right about Ukraine being era defining. And the only thing that's happened in my lifetime that feels on like a similar footing is 9/11, in terms of like, it just, the whole world just kind of changed. Yeah, you do feel a huge amount of responsibility. Like, we've got to get this right and we've got to do it properly. And I mean, you always feel that whenever you're covering any conflict. But on this one, you just have that every once in a while, you kind of think about how deep it goes and how far it goes, the ripple effect of Ukraine. It's just like really being felt all around the world, from like Somalia with like famine looming to, you know, Europe to the U.S. I mean, everywhere. So you do feel occasionally like a little overwhelmed by it because it's so huge. And it's quite scary, honestly. I don't mean like being on the ground even, but just like in terms of like this seismic moment in history. But you also, at the end of the day, when you're in your flow and you're in the zone, like, you just kind of get on with it. And instead of like looking at the top of the mountain, you just look like right in front of you. Like, what do I need to do today? Like, what's the most important part of this story today? Like, what do people really need to know today? What are people on the ground? Like, what have they been going through? And what do they, you know, how can I help amplify their voices and give their experience? And so it's a lot of like balanced considerations.
Yeah. And speaking of amplifying voices, I feel like sometimes in the West, we've got this mentality that we can focus on one problem at a time. So like if we're focused on Ukraine, we're not focused on what's happening in Afghanistan. So as a war correspondent and as somebody who's kind of tried to bring sort of voices of people everywhere to view, what's a conflict or a disaster that you feel maybe isn't getting the coverage that it needs?
Somalia. Somalia is, well, it's both a conflict and a disaster. I think there's a very, very good chance that famine will be declared there by the end of the year. And it's closely tied to Ukraine in terms of rising food prices, rising energy prices. So the difficulty becomes not that they can't get the food, but that the food costs twice as much as it did before. Mm-hmm. And it's also very difficult for aid agencies to raise money for Somalia right now, because people are understandably kind of fixated on Ukraine. And a lot of people, when they give their money, they want it to go to Ukraine. So yeah, Somalia is like just one example, but also Afghanistan is another. Yeah. I mean, look at the, you know, it's a disaster on many levels. You have suicide bombings there now, like every week, if not every day. Honestly, a lot of them you don't even hear about because they're smaller in scale. And you're going, and you have an unprecedented economic unraveling there. And you have a deteriorating food stability. I mean, so like, yeah, there's a lot of really intense, terrible stuff happening in the world right now. And it can be hard to like put a spotlight on all of it at the same time. But you also like this is sort of part of like the reality of what we do as journalists, like, and of news and how people consume news. Like, I can't present you with 20 horrifying stories at once. Like, you will not, your natural reaction will be to just shut down and like not take any of them in. So the more sensible thing to do is to present you with like the one or two or maybe three where there are the most significant developments or changes on the ground that have potentially the most impact. And so it's not perfect, but I think it's it makes sense in many ways.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely. In a question about specifically like the digital age that we're in now, there's a saying that you're probably familiar with, that truth is the first casualty of war. And we've definitely sort of seen that in Ukraine. How do you deal with that in the field? How do you deal with this new threat to journalism that is disinformation?
I mean, disinformation has always been around, but now it's harder to spot, I would argue, because the main actors who are like using it and putting it out there are much savvier and much more technologically adept than before. So everything just takes longer because it's like every video you see, you need to then geolocate it. And by the way, it may be, they may be savvier and more sophisticated in how they present it, but we as sort of, you know, ordinary journalists are also savvier and more sophisticated in terms of how we're able to try to authenticate or verify it. So I am useless at this stuff, but we at CNN have amazing journalists who are really good at geolocating material, at going through the metadata to find out when it was actually shot, at, you know, comparing different videos to see where the angle that the bullet came or whatever it might be, and spotting fakes, etc. So everything that is like a massive disadvantage or a massively negative development has a kind of counter side where it's also like positive and can be used in good ways as well. My attitude tends to be that, like, you know, you sing from the rooftops to people that like everything you see or read or watch or consume as information, like you must be sure of its source. What is the source? It doesn't mean that you can't watch Russia Today. It just means that you have to know it's Russia Today when you watch it and understand what the strategic objective is of Russia Today and understand that facts are not part of the sort of priority list for Russia Today. And the problem you still have, even with smart people, I get forwarded videos all the time, like, hey, did you see this? And it's like, don't ever trust a video that's been forwarded to you on WhatsApp that says forwarded many times. Okay. Like, almost guaranteed it's either a joke, which is fine, like, laugh away. But if it's any kind of news video, like, it's not legit, almost certainly. So everyone really needs to try to be responsible adults about being much more savvy about the source of any material that you're consuming. And then I also just think, though, that journalists have to, like, you know, we can sit there and whinge about it all day, or like, we can just get on with it and be better at our job and hold ourselves to higher standards and also be transparent with, you know, in the case of CNN, with our viewers, like, this is how we did this story. This is how we got this interview. Because the more you do that, the more hopefully you're like building up trust with your viewer, your reader, whoever it might be. And these are our ethics. These are our standards. These are how we implement them. And this is what we found. There's not much more that you can do. You're not going to get rid of disinformation. Like, it's here to stay. It's been here a long time. It's morphing. It's becoming more sophisticated, and it's not going to go away. It's going to get more challenging. So we really need to focus on building up trust with people and being transparent about how we do our work and the standards that we hold ourselves to. And everyone else just needs to get on board with being mature adults about understanding where their material that they're consuming comes from.
I know we're pretty much at the end of time, so we'll just ask you one more quick question. So obviously we've got a lot of young journalists listening to the podcast. So what's the one piece of advice that you, as a seasoned journalist yourself, would give to somebody just starting out their career?
Be curious, listen, be open-minded. Like, don't feel that it's the thing about journalism. You can be the smartest kid in your class. You can be the hardest working kid. You can speak 1,000 languages. You can get a double fuzz. Like, nobody cares. You still have no idea what you're doing in the workplace. Right. So like, the biggest myth I think that people tell graduates is like, the world's your oyster. I mean, yes, it is, but also like, the world doesn't care about you. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I just mean like, that's real life. So don't be disheartened. It's going to take you probably a few years at least to get closer to where you want to be. And you've got to be willing to like do that grind. If you're really passionate about this, you're going to work overnights. You're going to make photocopies. You're going to do jobs that you hate, that you think are boring, that you think are beneath you. But that's part of the journey. And the most important thing you do to make it worthwhile along the way, find mentors, find people with experience, find people that you look up to, ask them questions. How did you do this? Why did you choose to frame the story that way? How did you come up with the questions that you were going to ask him? Constantly be curious and take advantage of the fact that, like, even if you're not doing the job that you dream of doing in those first few years, there are other people around you with a lot of experience who you can learn so much from. So be open to that. And yeah, ask a lot of questions.
Yeah, great advice. And Clarissa, thank you so much for joining us on the Meridian podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure. And for all listeners, Clarissa's book, which is called The Education of a Journalist, on all fronts, I should say, The Education of a Journalist, is available on Amazon. It's available in Waterstones and plenty of other bookstores. And if you're like me, I listen to it on Audible, so you can get it there too. Clarissa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, guys. I've really enjoyed our chat.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Meridian podcast. We hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as we enjoyed creating it. If you liked what you heard, why not subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts, so our latest episode lands in your feed. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok too, at the Meridian podcast. And if you've got an idea for an episode or would like to appear, send us an email at meridianpodcast@gmail.com. This episode was presented and edited by Michael Gorham and Amelia Hardy. The theme music is Impending Uncertainty by Gavin Luke and Solar Flare, licensed by Creative Commons. Until next time, thanks for listening.